Mr. Steffes. Daniel J. O'Brien, who is Assistant Attorney General, will represent the state of Wisconsin. This is 11AP691-CR. Now, before we allow you to begin, we have one other matter, so you may, both may be seated. We have with us the Globe University Paralegal Program. With the students in the paralegal program, please stand. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We invite students from universities, technical schools, high schools, middle schools to come and join us for oral argument. And if they decide to join us, we give them materials about the case, and they may engage in some activities relating to those materials and this case. We also assign a justice for the day to meet with the students, and there'll be additional students at 10:45 and also at 1:30. This is a national award-winning program, and we find it interesting to speak with the students. And today's presentation after the second oral argument will be made by Justice Bradley. If anyone would like a summary, of case we're about to hear, would you raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary? All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, with whom you'll meet. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. To his right is Justice Annette Siegler. With those introductions made, we're now ready for counsel. Jeffrey Jensen representing Matthew Steffes.
Anne, may it please the court, I am attorney Jeffrey Jensen, and I represent the petitioner appellant Matthew Steffes. The primary and most important issue in this case calls upon the court to decide the question of what is property and what are services. Because what's at issue here is a convicted violation of Section 943.20, theft by fraud. And that statute provides that it is a crime to obtain title to the property of another by fraud. So in other words, the statute applies only to property, not to fraud. The statute has been on the books for many, many years, and I think at the time the statute was written, the legislature had a good reason for drawing a distinction between property and services. The statute itself speaks in terms of obtaining title, and I think throughout the years the courts have interpreted that to mean taking possession. In other words, a person is able to take possession of property, can use it, could conceivably sell it to some other person, and it's a tangible item. Whereas services cannot be possessed. It's simply something, some work that one person does for another person. When the statute was written, the distinction between property and services, I think, was fairly concrete. You could hold the goods in your hand. You could move them from one place to another. You could store them on inventory. You could set them out for sale. Services you could not. And to the extent there was some overlap between the concepts of goods and services, the legislature wrote that, just so there's no question, electricity and gas are goods. They're not services.
And that was a really huge difference, wasn't it? Because you sure wouldn't want to try to hold electricity in your hands.
That's exactly right. But the individuals, the people who wrote that statute, I'm sure could have never imagined the extent to which the distinction between goods and services would be blurred in our modern information and service economy, where really the engine that drives economic activity is the World Wide Web and the wireless communication facilities. So that's why I think this is a really important issue that I do not think the court ought to approach in the way that the Court of Appeals did and simply say that the word or the concept of electricity is broad enough to include all of the various forms of applied electricity, because if you do that, then this already blurred distinction becomes a distinction almost without any meaning.
Counselor, if you don't look at it that way, how would you ever have electricity as property? We always apply it to something, whether we're lighting the light bulbs in our house or I don't understand how the term can be defined by the legislature as property, but have it not be applied to something. What? How would you have electricity that wasn't applied to anything?
If we say that electricity, that applied electricity, is property under the statute, then every conceivable form of service that I can think of in this day and age would be property. For example, I may need a haircut soon. If I go into the barbershop and I say, my name is John Green, I'm from Seattle, Washington, I'd like to have my hair cut, the barber plugs his clipper in and gives me the haircut, and then I stand up and say, you know what, I don't really have any money in my pocket, and I walk out the door. If applied electricity is property, then that is the crime of theft by fraud, because the electricity was turned into the electrical mechanical.
But my question is the opposite of your answer. My question was, if we don't have electricity, including applied electricity, how could we ever have it as property that could be stolen under this statute?
Well, there's electricity that's applied by the power companies, and I really think that is what was intended by the statute.
It used to be that when I grew up in New York City, that the urban legend, and I think it was an urban legend, was that if you put a penny in the meter, you slow down or significantly the electricity, the current that is being monitored and metered. Therefore, the meter would show less electricity than you use, so then you were stealing electricity.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Then you were stealing electricity because you were fixing the meter to show only X number of whatever it was rather than X plus, two times X. That's stealing electricity if you siphon it off.
Yes, definitely. But maybe I misunderstood the question. The question is, how could anybody ever be convicted of stealing electricity by fraud if it doesn't include the applied forms of electricity.
You got to apply it to something.
Correct. And I think that Chief Justice's example is one example of how that could happen. Other ways would be you sign up for electrical power service under the name of Doyette Typing Service, Nails by Renee, and you use that to run your lights, your typewriters, your computers, and things of that nature. I think that would be violate the statute of theft by fraud, 943.20.
Okay, so what you're doing is you are just limiting it to direct provision to the customer that somehow is adjusted so that the provider of the electricity to, say, a household or a business is not fully compensated for what they gave.
That's correct,
okay.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Yes.
I have a question for you. This is a case, at least the one issue. Are you giving up on the other issues, or are you relying on your brief?
Well, I'll be talking about those other issues briefly, but I really, as I said, think the most important issue is this one, because how the court decides what is property and what is service, I think is going to have wide-ranging importance throughout the state and who gets charged with what.
So it's a statutory interpretation case.
Yes, I believe so.
Now, here's my question. 943.45 of the statutes deals directly with theft of telecommunications service.
Right.
Why don't you argue that that covers this case and it's a more specific statute than this general statute? Therefore, they charged him with the wrong crime.
Well, I wish I had been the trial lawyer because I would have made that exact argument, and I have actually discussed that at length with Mr. Steffes, and I can only speculate as to why he was charged in that way, and my speculation is that I believe the prosecutor believed he could create a greater penalty structure charging Mr. Steffes with the theft of applied electricity because of the provision that if it's over $2,500, it becomes a felony and things of that nature. That's just my speculation. But you are correct. There is a statute that does deal specifically with what's alleged here.
And it's a Class C forfeiture. If it's B to D, and it's C to D is a Class B misdemeanor.
Correct.
But does that mean that the legislature enacts a specific statute dealing specifically with this kind of telecommunication service? That isn't that showing that it wasn't covered by the other one? Now, they sometimes have statutes that overlap, et cetera. But, you know, the specific is generally reviewed rather than the general. Now, I don't know if this is communications under 182.0171GCQ. Do you?
I don't know right offhand. But in response to the question, that was discussed, and I don't know exactly what was going through Mr. Landgraf's mind when he issued these charges, but my speculation is what I just conveyed to the court.
I'm going to ask the same question of the state's counsel. And the real question is statutory interpretation. And what light does that shed on the interpretation of the statute at issue here?
Correct. And as I said, and as we've been discussing, I think this is a very important distinction because if the Supreme Court decides this issue in a manner consistent with what the Court of Appeals did, then I think we are going to see a rash of prosecutions throughout the state under similar theories that the prosecutor in this case used, that you have stolen what is, in effect, services. However, because the provision of this form of service required the use of electricity, you are subject to being prosecuted under the theft by fraud statute. The question that I was asked was whether I was abandoning the other two issues, and I'm not abandoning them. I do intend to rely primarily on the brief, but I would like to say a few words about the idea that any form of misrepresentation of fact constitutes a violation of the theft by fraud statute. This high-tech question comes to the court with a decidedly low-tech factual background. This was a plan that was hatched by Joshua Howard, who was a prisoner in the Wisconsin State Prison at Waupun. And he was able to cajole his girlfriends into setting up numerous telephone lines that he would then call and have the girlfriends do three-way calls to whomever Mr. Howard and eventually Mr. Steffes wanted them to do it. I would have to say that a reasonable inference under the facts that were presented at trial were that these people never intended to pay for the telephone services. I don't think that can be disputed. We're reviewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. But the question is what misrepresentations of fact were made and whether those were material to prompting the telephone company to set up the services.
Well, was some of these done by credit card?
I don't know the answer to that, but I'm more than happy to find the answer to that and submit a letter to the court.
Is it in the record or not, or don't you know?
I don't know right offhand.
Because the credit card transactions say that you agree to pay the bills. So if you buy a service, buy something, let's say tangible property under this definition, if you buy it with a credit card and you represent that you intend to pay and you don't intend to pay, I mean, it's different if I really would like to pay, I intend to pay, I have no money, but I intend to pay if and when I ever get money. That's not a crime, I guess. But if you do a credit card and you know you're not going to pay, then you could be subject to criminal action under this statute. That's what the state's arguing.
Yes, and I don't have the entire record here, but I do have my summary of the record here, and I'm looking at my summary of the testimony of Rhiannon Hoffman, who was one of the ladies who set up these lines, and her testimony, according to my summary here, was that she established the lines without ever really describing exactly how she did it. Off the top of my head, I don't recall there being any testimony that it was done by credit card, but I will check on that and inform the court. But in the example you just gave to me, I think that could be conceivably a fraudulent representation. The victim in that case probably would be the credit card company, because the credit card would be used, assuming it's in the defendant's name, and the credit card company would make payment to the telephone company, and then it would be the credit card company who would be out of the money if the defendant decided not to pay it. But I think that's a very different circumstance from what we have here. What I recall the testimony from reading the transcript being is that it was fairly nebulous that these girls just testified that they established these lines, and calling upon my own experience, in that day and age, I believe you could just call AT&T and say, "This is John Doe. I live at 123 Mockingbird Lane. I need a telephone installed," and they would do it and start sending you bills. So the fact that no promise was made by any of the young women involved in this conspiracy, I think, is also an important distinction. The only actual misrepresentation that was made to AT&T was the fact that this is so-and-so calling from Doyette Typing Service, this is so-and-so calling from Renee's Nails in West Bend, Wisconsin, and there was no testimony that from AT&T or SBC at the time that had they been given the girls' real names, they wouldn't have established the service. And so I think there's no way of getting around the fact that giving a phony name for the account holder was not, in this case, a material misstatement of fact, at least under the facts of this record. I guess I could imagine a circumstance where the identity of the account holder could be material, but there was no such testimony in this case. For example, if Bill Gates called up and said, "I need a PBX system installed at such and such a building," I think the telephone company would be justified in assuming he's got the money to pay.
Counselor, you know, I was a little concerned about your statement that if the court holds that applied electricity comes within the statute here, there'll just be a rash of cases. But, you know, there is another statute, 94350, parent 1R, which talks about the theft of services, and that's kind of your argument here, that this is services. It's 94351R. I'll let you get there. If there is a violation of that section, there is a theft of services, if he'd been charged under that section, then it's, you know, it's dollar dependent, just like the one we're dealing with, but you can still have a felony for violating 1R. So I don't know that there's going to be a rash of cases. They might bring them under a different statute, 1R, and if the value is high enough, they're still going to end up having a felony for conviction if the count is proved. But I'm not sure that we're going to open the floodgates. Now, I don't know how, you know, what do you say to that? That's basically
Here's what I say to that. Okay. I never intended to suggest that people who go around stealing services, and especially as somebody who is in the business of providing services, and I contend with this on a daily basis, people promise to pay me for my services, I give them my services, and then there's a problem. So I don't mean to suggest that people who do that shouldn't be prosecuted. My argument is that Matthew Steffes, under this, the facts of this case, did not commit this crime because what he conspired to steal was not a good.
It was a service that might have come under 1R, but he wasn't charged under 1R.
That was the prosecutor's decision to proceed in that way. And he may or may not have the discretion to do that, but if he exercises discretion in that way, then I think, as far as all of us are concerned, he's stuck with it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I understand better now.
Counsel, what is your, let me ask it this way, is your third issue, the issue regarding the jury instruction, is that an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, or how would you describe your third issue?
It was raised in the post-conviction motion, I believe, as plain error, but also as ineffective assistance of counsel. Plain error in the sense that it is an inaccurate statement of the law. And if that isn't the case, if the court decided not to treat it as plain error, then it was ineffective assistance of counsel for trial counsel to have failed to object to that. The trial court denied the post-conviction motion without a hearing, and so that was, I raised it in the Court of Appeals in terms of ineffective assistance of counsel.
How are you raising it here? On page 5 of your brief, you state it as a erroneous jury instruction, and then you go on to indicate in issue 3, and further, whether defense counsel was ineffective for failing to object to the defective jury instruction. On page 7, when you restate the issue, you don't have anything about ineffective assistance of counsel. Rather, the issue is the plain error in the jury instruction. So what's the different theories have different analyses. So what's your argument with regard, and I mean this just for clarification.
Correct.
What is your argument with regard to issue 3?
Well, I find myself in the situation that this court condemned in State versus Lucimba Love, where an arguable claim of ineffective assistance of counsel is made, and the trial court doesn't conduct a hearing, I am almost forced to either raise it in terms of the trial court erred in not conducting a hearing, or that it was plain error. And in this case, I chose to raise it, despite maybe some of my language to the contrary, as plain error. Because if, you know, the argument is that the real controversy wasn't tried because I think the prosecutor was aware of the fact that nobody made any express promises to pay for anything or anything that was a material misrepresentation that prompted SBC to provide the services. And that's why he urged the judge to use that phrase, a promise may be express or implied. And I think if you look at Mr. Landgraf's closing argument, that's exactly what he argued, that we all know that if we sign up for telephone services, we have to pay for it. So this idea that we didn't know we had to pay for the phones that we signed up for is specious.
Well, one, there were false representations about names of corporations or entities, etc. And your argument there, if I understand it, is none of them were significant in terms of this conspiracy.
Correct.
None of these false representations, either reliance or any other theory, did not go to the heart of this. That's one argument I think I read. The second argument I read is the one that Justice Bradley's talking about. And there, as I understand your argument, there is that there was no false representation that was fraudulent because no one ever asked them when they set this up to pay, right?
Right.
They never made an express promise to pay.
Correct.
And you cannot, under the law, imply a promise to pay. Is that your argument?
Well, it's close, but I would say it's not exact. And here's
Give it to me exact.
It has to do with the intent to steal aspect of it.
Okay.
The question would be, was this a situation where I ordered these services where from the very beginning I didn't intend to pay?
Right.
Or was this a situation where in my mind I believed I could afford it and then later on my financial circumstances went downhill and I couldn't pay for it?
Well, if you can't pay for it but you always intended to pay,
yes,
it's not a crime. At least
and,
under
right.
this.
And here the argument is, I don't think there is enough circumstantial evidence to allow the inference to be drawn that they did not intend to pay from the get-go. And in fact, I'm referring to my summary from the trial transcript. I believe that Ms. Hoffman testified that she in fact did intend to pay at some point. You know, for the service.
This is my problem. On page 6 of your reply brief, you say there is no getting around the inference that in setting up the accounts, the members of the conspiracy had no intention of paying for the services at the time they set them up. I just put in at the time they set them up, but that's what this says. So,
yes, right. And what I mean by that is.
Yeah.
They may have had the intent to steal, but the intent to steal does not necessarily equate to fraud unless they make some misrepresentation of fact to the telephone company at the time the account is set up.
Okay, but there was no direct, explicit misrepresentation, I
There
understand.
Was not.
And you're objecting to an implication from these facts that there was an agreement that the telephone company thought they had an agreement to be paid, but that your client did not, or his co-conspirators did not.
Right. And I mentioned a moment ago, I'm in the process of providing services. And the rules that this court has created for all of us in effect prohibits this situation where somebody comes in and says, I'd like to have you represent me in this criminal case, and I say, no problem, I'll represent you, and then later on I start demanding money. It's required that these promises be expressed and in writing if it's more than $1,000 to avoid the situation of not knowing, was this fraud in the beginning or was this just a change in financial circumstances or what happened. But I don't think you can or should be prosecuted for the crime of theft by fraud where your misrepresentation is by implication. That comes, in my mind, dangerously close to criminalizing private thoughts almost. You know, so that's the answer to the question. And I see the red light is on, so I will have a seat.
Thank you. And you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Jensen. Daniel O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. O'Brien.
May it please the court, one point at the outset. Mr. Jensen's legal services are not property. Electricity is property, and the state legislature made that clear. Mr. Jensen, as a lawyer, purveys legal services to his clients, and if they do not pay for those, that person can be charged with theft.
Mr. O'Brien, I always thought that the telephone company provides the telephone.
It does not. It provides the wire, the apparatus to get the voice impulses to the telephone at the individual's home or business. The electricity, and in that sense, the telephone company is no different than the electric company. And I would suggest that if you accept Mr. Jensen's position, than if someone steals directly from the electric company to power all of the appliances in his or her home or business, then that too cannot be prosecuted under this statute. And I, because that too involves electricity as applied. Electricity by itself has no value to the consumer unless the consumer can access it. And the telephone, both the telephone company and the electric company allow the consumer the apparatus for accessing. And the state's theory here was both that these conspirators stole property from, in the form of electricity, and in doing so, they stole it in its applied form by accessing unlawfully the apparatus and using the telephone company's wiring system, its equipment, its switching devices, all of the telecommunications, the technology that moves those voice impulses from the telephone company switching station to the business or the residence.
That's
that is
true.
All, in my view, tangible property, because it is, the definition is tangible property includes without limitation electricity and a whole bunch of other things. And
true, Mr. O'Brien. I have trouble then with the 26,000 or 24,000 that we're talking about. That amount of money dealt with telephone services, the value of the telephone services, not the value of the applied electricity. What's the value of the applied electricity?
Well, again, as applied, again, the statute is clear on this. The value is the fair market value. And the value, I get back to the example of Mr. Jensen's legal services, providing a service to an individual as a professional, as a consultant, as opposed to service, which is access to tangible property of the phone company. That has, the market dictates what the value of that is.
Counsel, the market may dictate the value, but the value there was of telephone services, not the value of the applied electricity. You know, electricity has gone out in entire regions. As a matter of fact, telephone service in the capital is still out in some offices. I don't know how your offices are doing, Mr. O'Brien, but some of the court's offices don't have telephone. We find it very difficult to render our services without a telephone. And if all the electricity went out in the Risser Justice offices, I bet all the lawyers would go home. And that you couldn't do any services as a lawyer without electricity. Lights, the internet, or anything else.
But again, that electrical service is incidental to the professional service.
Only because you say so. But to me...
Well, theoretically, you could consult with your client out on the street in broad daylight without any electricity.
But not at night.
You could do it in a dark alley if you wanted to as well. I imagine some lawyers do meet with some of their clients in dark alleys at night. The phone company is, Mr. Jensen as a lawyer is not providing electricity. He's using electricity. The phone company is providing electricity
to the
customer.
The phone company
is
using electricity
to
provide a service. There's the rub.
Well, in his reply brief, Mr. Jensen specifically says the central point of Steffi's argument is SBC is not a purveyor of electricity. That's wrong. It is a purveyor of electricity, just as the electric company is a purveyor of electricity, and that is borne out by the testimony of Mr. Lindsley, the expert. Testified at trial on the fourth day, or now August 4th, where he talks about the whole apparatus and the valuable apparatus that you are accessing when you contract with the company to get an electrical line hooked up to your home or business. And he talks about, this is, I believe it's, I don't know if it's transcript 118, I believe, pages 7 through 12. And I would suggest not only read his direct, but his cross-examination. I mean, he specifically asked by defense counsel, electricity is required for a telephone to work, correct? Absolutely, yes. But before that, he explains why that is. And he talks about how the phone company purchases electricity. He talks about the difference between AC power and DC power, and that AC power is purchased from the electrical company. Here would be MG&E, I assume, by the phone company. But then it is stored by the phone company in DC form so that it can be stored in batteries. So if the AC power goes out or in the community, the phone company can still provide you service even if all the rest of your electricity is out. So you've got a phone, but all your lights are out, theoretically. And he talks about how that is then purveyed to the customer over the lines with the voice impulses from the switching station to the business or residence. This is
were
not
these
anything.
Landlines, were these landlines rather
yeah, these
than
were landlines, yes.
Would it matter if this was a mobile phone?
I'm sorry?
Would it matter if this was a mobile phone?
I got to say, I'm not
my
sure.
Technological.
I mean, mobile phones use electricity in the form of storage. Electricity is stored in batteries. And, of course, it could be hooked up electrically as well if you are charging it and the phone rings and you answer.
I'm just talking about the telephone service, not
but again,
charging the battery.
You know, and it's interesting, you brought up the definition of communications from the statute 182.017,
right.
And right. I looked at it. You know, that definition is pretty darn specific. And to me, that's not akin to a lawyer's service or a barber's service.
Is it akin
that
to telephone
hard,
service?
Hard wiring, hardcore apparatus's property. That's what we're really talking about. We're talking about high-tech property, but, you
so
know.
Would it have been charged under that statute?
It could have been, but it doesn't have to be. And I, you know, there's a real important case here that Mr. Jensen has never addressed in his brief, and it's State v. Pleckelman, the Court of Appeals decision 299 with second 251 that I cited liberally, and he never responded to. Pleckelman answers that question. It's right on point. That's the one who made the false representation, the farmer who made the false representation, he didn't make a fault. This answers two questions. It answers your 943-45 question, and it answers the false misrepresentation question. Pleckelman says, in black letter law, yes, you can have a false representation by implication. Number two, Pleckelman says, even though there's a very specific statute of misdemeanor for selling taint or fraudulent milk sales, you can be charged under the theft by fraud statute, the felony theft by fraud statute for fraudulent milk sales if the state can prove it. And it talks about the United States Supreme Court decision in United States v. Batchelder, which says when there's, and of course 939-65 expressly allows the prosecutor to do exactly what was done here, that if you have two charges covering the same facts, and one's a felony and one's a misdemeanor, you can go under the felony in the exercise of your prosecutorial discretion. That's all that was done here. And and the other case that's not discussed is the State v. Meadow decision out of the Court of Appeals, which also dealt with this situation where there was a theft by fraud charged under 943-20, where the individual retained a leased vehicle. So there was no title, there was not even any ownership. And this is analogous to the situation here where you're accessing telephone company property, the apparatus, unlawfully for an extended period of time. In Meadow, the guy retained a leased vehicle and was charged with theft by fraud, and the conviction was held by the Court of Appeals, even though there was another statute that specifically, a misdemeanor statute that specifically addressed unlawful retention of leased property. So that...
I
939-65 and Batchelder foreclosed that argument unless this court agrees that the facts just don't fit 943-20. If they fit, then the prosecutor has every right to make that charging decision.
No, I totally agree. And you've got lots of statutes that overlap. And there are times where a prosecutor can have a choice of three or four, even five statutes, and the prosecutor can choose any one or more, right? I agree with that. But to me, this is a question of statutory interpretation. What was intended by electricity in that statute? And so what you have to look at is the exact language and the application here. And you've got some after-the-fact legislative history. You've got one, this 943-45 that deals with telecommunications, which seems to make theft of telecommunications less onerous or as penalty. Then you got the statute that Justice Rokensack referred to as retail theft. But the retail theft, 943-50, not until a statute was adopted in December 2011 would that have covered theft of services. And it was amended now to cover theft of services. You think they did it in light of our cases or this case coming through that indicated that maybe a problem?
I really don't know. All I know is in the old, in the 50 and 53 versions, when they talked about services, they were talking more in the nature of the lawyer who's defrauded, the barber who's defrauded. They weren't contemplating telecommunications services such as we're talking about now, in my mind. Now, and as far as 943-45 goes, my best guess would be that they were contemplating the sort of general consumer fraud where someone gets a telephone line to their house and doesn't pay the bill. I don't know that they ever contemplated an elaborate burnout phone conspiracy such as this.
Well, but 943-45, which is the telecommunications, I thought it dated back at least to 1977, but my recollection could be wrong. I'll check that right away. So you've got a very old statute that covers this. It shows this 1977, Chapter 173 on telecommunications services. So that dates back and seems to cover it.
Yeah,
it was amended in 2011 to change the reference from the as to the defined telecommunications from 196.019M to 182.0171GCQ, but I don't think there's much of a change there. So you got a very old statute specifically covering telecommunications.
You know, again, it's I go back to the Pleckelman case and the tainted milk. And you had a very specific statute that had a far lower penalty that the prosecutor could have chosen. And he chose the greater because of the scheme was greater. I could be totally wrong, but I'd be real surprised if the legislature, when they enacted 943-45, said, not only will this prevent Mr. and Mrs. Jones from obtaining fraudulently obtaining telephone service to their house to make phone calls to their children without paying, but it also will encompass prison burnout telephone schemes that go on for a year and a half. That's theft by fraud. That's not just consumer fraud. And those are two entirely different concepts, two entirely different statutes. Both are properly applied to these facts, and the prosecutor, in the exercise of the broad charging discretion that prosecutors in the state have, had every right, and I would say almost the duty, to go under the theft by fraud statute for what went on here, as opposed to this slap on the wrist, 943-45, would apply to the typical consumer who defrauds the telephone company.
Steff was in prison when he was charged with this crime, right? I mean, he committed this crime while he was in prison, right?
Correct.
Is he still in prison? What was his first?
I believe so because there were a number of serious felonies prior to this. So I think I'm almost positive that he's still serving time for quite a while.
Yes.
Before, in fact, I'm not sure that this sentence has even kicked in yet. But
that's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I know it was made consecutive, so I'm not sure that it's even started yet.
Counsel, in your earlier comments, you were focusing on the definition of property set forth in 943.20 sub 2 sub B, and I'd like to return to that. As I understood your comments as you were referring to that, you said that it was expansive, the definition of property, that it meant all sorts of property and including without limitation electricity. Then you talked about the property here, including, as I recall, transmission lines as property and transmitter as property, and I maybe even part of the switching station apparatus, I can't remember. Is that the property that you are also suggesting was stolen here, the transmission lines and the transmitter?
It's the property that was stolen was the electricity, but also the unlawful access to the telephone company's property that enabled the electricity to be transmitted to these fraud lines. And so it's both. It's incumbent. And I think this theory was born out of trial. If you look at the...
Just a moment. Is there a difference between, under this statute, unlawful access and to property and theft by property? Your answer was it's unlawful access. My question was that property, in your argument, property that was stolen and subject to prosecution, that is, the transmission lines and the transmitter?
Again, the electricity has no use to the customer without that apparatus. So in order to steal the electricity, the person has to have unlawful access and use of that apparatus for the however length of time that line is open.
Is so unlawful access and use commensurate with theft?
I think if you, I go back to the Court of Appeals decision in State v. Meadow, 163 was second, where the unlawful access and use was the person who leased a Chevy van without any, with no intent of returning it, and that he had use of that car for an extended period of time. The company learned right away that he wrote a bad check. They couldn't get back from him. He fraudulently provided a false name and address, and he was charged. He could have been charged under the unlawful retention of leased property statute, but for that amount of time that he had that van under the fraudulent lease, he was, in essence, stealing access to that property that was still owned by the other person.
And that's my question. Yeah. Is the unlawful use of the transmission lines and the transmitter, in essence, theft of that property?
It is here because it also enabled him to steal the electricity, which is clearly covered by the statute.
What is the value of the transmission line use and transmitter
stolen? The fair market value. That what would a paying customer pay? What value is this to the phone company? What they spend millions of dollars to set up this apparatus. They pay taxes. This has a value, and the statute says, what is that value? It's fair market value. And
the value.
So it's not just the pure form of.
The value of the transmission lines and the value of the transmitter, which are property, is that in any way different from the value of the service?
See, I guess that I wish we. I would rather use, instead of the word service, I would say facilities. I mean, we're getting hung up because, again, this type of service where the service is purveying electricity. That's really what we're talking about here. It's not giving legal advice. It's not cutting a hair. It's purveying electricity. These are all accoutrements of that service. And whether that's a wire, a switching system, or a secretary who takes a phone call from a customer who wants to set up a line, that's part of that service. but it's all part of the purvey. It's no different, again, than the electric company. I just built a house. I want service to my new house at such and such, such and such. Okay, we'll set it up. And, you know, we'll enter a contract, and there'll be a bill every month. Again, if we take his argument and Mr. Jensen's argument to the logical conclusion, this statute doesn't even apply to electric companies, because that in itself is an applied form. And, you know, I cited the Massachusetts Supreme Court decision in Catalano, where the person set up basically a burnout electrical scheme to get power directly from an electrical company, and there was all kinds of testimony as to the fair market value of that, and they said that that's theft. It's theft under their version of 943.20, because you're basically stealing applied electricity in its applied form. You can't, the electricity doesn't have value to the customer without all these accoutrements, without these facilities, without quote unquote the service. But that is a different service than stealing, you know, consulting fees or stealing, or you know, getting, having consultations with a lawyer and not paying, or getting your hair cut and running out the door.
Counsel, unless I'm missing something, it doesn't seem as though your argument concerning the electricity being tangible property is overly complex. In order to supply telephone service, in other words, the service we associate with the telephone company, which is the transmission of vocal impulses throughout the wires, throughout the infrastructure of the telephone company, the telephone company must acquire, and they acquire by purchasing electricity from a provider, which they then store and then apply in order to generate the electricity necessary to power the infrastructure that goes to the service of the customer using the telephone. And therefore, the electricity has value when it is applied to the telephone service. And to separate the two is impossible, because there is no value to the electricity unless it is used as part and parcel of the service. Does that about sum it up, or have I missed something?
I don't think you really missed much of anything there.
In other words, you're saying someone's got to pay for this electricity. The telephone company doesn't get it for free, presumably. They have to pay for it. The testimony indicates what they pay for it, and the testimony also indicates the fair market value of the electricity as it's been applied to the telephone service. Does that sum up your argument?
I believe so. Yeah, and the statute specifically says fair market value. And, the electricity, as electricity standing by itself, really has no value to the consumer without this apparatus. And again, I refer back to Mr. Lindsley's testimony, where he talks about how they get the electricity in its AC form from the electricity purveyor, the electric company, and then store it in DC form and then purvey it over the lines to their customers, the lines that produce, as this court acknowledged, you know, we have modern technology now, but in 1884, in Wisconsin Telephone v. City of Oshkosh, this court says electrical, telephone, and telegraph systems are the same in that they send voice impulses over electric lines.
And as an aside, this case has occasioned the opportunity for me to learn the answer to a question I have wondered about from time to time, which is, why is it when the electricity in your house goes out, the telephone still works?
And Mr. Lindsley tells you that sometimes the AC goes out, but they have the DC, and so you
because can, they bought it they and bought they it. Stored it, and then they provided it to the customer for a fee.
And it has a fair market value, and that fair market value, it includes taxes, it includes a reasonable profit, it includes the cost of the apparatus, the equipment.
It includes the cost of acquiring all of the rights to the property to use to set up and build the infrastructure.
Research and
development. The infrastructure itself, the professionals to run it, none of which has value unless it's used in association with the telephone service.
The cost of hiring people like Mr. Lindsley to set up the whole darn thing. And so, that is something, and again, the jury doesn't have to buy it. Let's not forget, we're basically here on a review of a sufficiency of the evidence challenge. And the jury could say, you know, the state didn't really prove fair market value.
Just stop for 1 minute. Who decides whether or not this kind of electricity falls under the statute? The jury, or is this a question of law for the trial court and for us?
Well, I mean, this was hashed out before trial.
What about here? What about here?
And
who decides whether this kind of electricity falls within the statute? The jury or this court as a matter of law?
I think that a jury presented with the facts, such as were presented here and as Justice Gableman has summarized, can make that determination as to whether that is electricity within the contemplation of the statute.
So you're saying the jury interprets the law?
They were instructed that property includes without limitation electricity. Now, what electricity means, I think, does depend on the facts of the case. It depends on who the purveyor is, what they're purveying, how it's purveyed.
Right. Were they all instructed about all of that?
They were not just instructed in that great of detail. They were given the statutory definition. They were told that electricity is property. The theories were presented, and the prosecutor discussed both the theft of the property and the unlawful access to the apparatus that allowed them to steal the property. And they went into the value.
I have to double back. I'm sorry, but I didn't look at the instructions. Were they instructed that electricity, as in this case, the applied electricity was, as a matter of law, tangible property under the statute?
They were not specific. They were told that property, electricity is property in Wisconsin under the statute. They were not told that electricity in its applied form with the apparatus is, as a matter of law, okay, property. However, the parties discussed that, and the prosecutor discussed that and explained how it's applied. And, of course, Mr. Lindsley's testimony talks about how it's applied. And so that factual theory got to the jury, and they could accept it or reject it. And that specific language, electricity in its applied form as property, was not given to the jury.
You know, there's no question in my mind that this was an elaborate scheme to steal, and that they had no intention, on the basis of this, the inference is they had no intention to ever pay for these telephone calls. And that starting out with no intention to pay and setting up an elaborate scheme with multiple numbers and multiple names and multiple entities all lead to the inference that there's an intent here to steal. The only question I have is, under what statute should he be prosecuted? I mean, there's no question he's doing something that if it's not illegal, it should be illegal. The question is, did the legislature make it illegal? And under what statute?
Well, first of all, they were prosecuted under the conspiracy statute, 939, the inchoate conspiracy, which I think is perfectly proper because this is about as elaborate as it gets for, you know, a bunch of just average people putting together something pretty elaborate. But the theft portion of it, you know, again, that's prosecutorial discretion. We have tens of thousands of dollars of valuable property.
I think you answered that question before, counsel, when you said, what difference does it make so long as the elements of the offense are met?
That's right, and that's the question. If these facts fit the statute, then it doesn't make a difference. If it doesn't, then obviously you can't go under it. But if they do, the prosecutor has the discretion, and because of the elaborate nature of this scheme, because of the amount of the value that was lost to the phone company for this scheme that went on, again, for a year and a half, and thousands of calls were made, long-distance collect calls, thousands. You know, 943.45 just doesn't get you there. And this does. And a prosecutor has every right to say, this is a conspiracy. This is big league theft. This is theft of very valuable property. And it needs to be prosecuted, and a reasonable jury could draw reasonable inferences from these facts and say, yes, that is conspiracy to commit felony theft. I see my red light is on, so I'll conclude my argument.
Could I ask?
Justice Prosser.
Could I ask, Mr. O'Brien, how do you deal with the word title to property? What's the quick
Yeah, and that, you know, the legislative history, and then the recent cases such as the Meadow case, the Court of Appeals, the O'Neill case, and I believe Pleckelman itself, talk about that that's more a term of art, and you don't have to pass formal legal title. It's the crux of the crime is the obtaining of property from another under false pretenses with the intent to deceive and the actual defrauding. And so it is a relatively archaic term, but I think the cases are uniform. The title, you don't have to pass title. In the Meadow case, again, was where there was a lease. So there, the title remained with the Chevy dealership or whoever it was. And then I think O'Neill was a case where money was fraudulently obtained. And again, you don't get a formal title to money. You just get the $100 bill. So that's my best answer, is that it's more the conveyance of the unlawful conveyance of the property as opposed to a written formal legal title.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Do you have further questions, Justice Prosser?
No. Okay.
Mr. Jensen.
I was happy to hear that this discussion about cellular telephone service came up because it highlights an inconsistency in the law. If the state's suggestion that this applied electricity is property because it flows into one's home through copper wires and is used to provide the telephone service, then cellular telephone service is not property because I charge my cell phone with electricity I buy from We Energies. It's transmitted to my house. And the telephone service is not provided through copper wires. It's provided through microwaves, electromagnetic energy.
Counselor, but doesn't the phone company still have to use electricity to get it to go through those processes before it goes through the cloud and comes to your phone?
Yes, it does. But what the state is saying here is that this is theft of electricity because literally the electricity flows from SBC into your home and can be used by your telephone.
Well, it flows from the company into the cloud into your cell phone. I mean, there's not a wire there, but you still have to have electrical transmission, right?
But electromagnetic radiation, I think, is different than actual electricity.
Well, it may be. It may be. Was that something that was discussed during the course of the trial? Was that an issue that was raised during the course of the trial?
I don't believe so. I don't recall that, though.
Okay. All right. Well, I think it's an interesting argument. Thank you.
And the second thing I wanted to point out...
Could you do this scheme with cell phones? Could you do this scheme with cell phones?
I think it would be much more difficult because cell phone providers don't allow collect calls. But you could probably... A person with a lot of time on his hands and some technical knowledge might be able to figure out a way of doing it. And you also can't have cell phones in prison. So that would be a bar to this exact scheme from being carried out.
Someone could do it outside of prison. That's what I'm asking.
We're not even allowed to bring our cell phones in. So, and the second thing is the state talks about Pleckelman and why I didn't distinguish it, because it seemed to me that based on the facts, even as represented by the state, it doesn't really help. In Pleckelman, a farmer took some high-grade milk and mixed it with his own milk and had the state examiner come in and he gets this seal of high-grade milk and then he sells it that way without telling the purchasers that it really isn't high-grade milk. I think that's a totally different situation than what we have here. And Pleckelman did say that you have...
I don't think he cited it for the proposition that the factual backgrounds were similar. I think he cited it for the proposition that the prosecutor enjoys discretion for charging so long as the elements of the offense are met.
Correct. But he, in his oral argument just now, he said that the failure to disclose can be a misrepresentation. In other words, that you can make a misrepresentation by conduct or failing to act. And what Pleckelman said is it has to be something you have a duty to disclose, such as the quality of the milk in that case. The argument the state would be making here then is that the women had the duty to disclose that they didn't intend to pay for the services, and that's really what the trial was all about. So I don't think the state showed there was a duty to disclose in this case. And then a final point to address a question that came to Mr. O'Brien that I uniquely know the answer to. Last Wednesday or Thursday, Mr. Steffes was before Judge Borowski in Milwaukee County Circuit Court, and Judge Borowski modified his sentence in a sealed proceeding under State versus Doe to what will in effect be a time-served disposition, including the time served on this case.
So he's soon to be out then?
If he's not out already, he will be out any day.
Does this make it moot?
Well, I don't think so. He still has the criminal conviction that he would like to not have on his record.
An extended supervision?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our hearing on an issue of the breadth or not of the theft statute. And we appreciate both your briefs and your oral argument. That ends the hearing on 11AP691CR, State versus Steffes. We'll take a few minutes in recess to allow